The Woman's Self-Health Podcast is a place where women can go to find support, information, and tools they need to take control of their own health. We discuss the needs of women so you can become your own self-help guru. From how to manage your stress, eating for effective weight loss, real talk on self-image, maintaining lifelong health, and healthy aging, we cover it all. Be sure to visit womenssshh.com for more information on everything discussed in today's episode.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Women's Self-Health Podcast. Today I am joined by Sean Webb. Sean is the author of Mind Hacking Happiness. He also does the I Am Podcast and runs mindhackinghappiness.com. We covered so much crucial content with Sean that we've decided to split this episode up into two parts. The work Sean is doing is absolutely groundbreaking, and you definitely want to grab a pen and paper ready for this episode. So in part one of this episode, we're discussing Sean's theory of the equation of emotion, what that actually means. We also talk about why our ego is actually called the self. And we also talk about why we have fear, how to recognize your fears, and how to dial down your level of emotion. We talk about a whole lot more in part two of the episode as well. Sean's discussing how the brain and our mind and also our emotions work from a science standpoint. And he goes into delving into the neuroscience behind our emotions. This is definitely one of those episodes that's going to leave you with a lot of questions. So grab that pen and paper. Get ready, and without further ado, let's get into the episode. Today I'm joined by Sean Webb, author of How Emotions Work in Humans and Computers, and the books Mind Hacking Happiness, Volumes 1 and 2. Sean has a podcast and YouTube series called The I Am Podcast and I Am Spirituality, where he teaches you how to use the neuroscience on happiness to experience increases in IQ, emotional intelligence, creativity, problem-solving skills, stress reduction, and improving your overall health and well-being. He has become one of the world's leading experts in how the human mind works, particularly in the area of human emotions, and I'm super excited to have him on the podcast today. Sean, thanks so much for joining us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Can you just start with letting us know how you got into developing this equation of emotion that you mentioned on your podcast series, and why did you decide to start the I Am podcast?
Sure. You know, about 18 years ago, I guess, I kind of ran into an epiphany that I explain in Mind Hacking Happiness Volume 2. And I kind of just all at once figured out everything that was ever bugging me in my mind because I kind of figured out how my mind worked. And so I took a couple of years to kind of sharpen that and just for my own good to say, okay, so here's the reason that, you know, I had angst about things and I was worried about things and I had anger issues about things and yada, yada, yada. And I was able to figure that out in a way that I could kind of explain it to myself from a systems point of view. I used to be a systems engineer for a supercomputing company. So my mind kind of puts things in a structured format. And then I started talking to other folks to say, hey, this is how my stuff works. And they were like, well, that can actually kind of apply to, you know, my stuff, my inner turmoil and my inner demons as well. And so I thought, well, that's interesting. So I started to do a lot more reading on the subject to figure out, you know, who else had figured this out or, you know, how I could read and understand more of it. And I started to discover that no one had really nailed this model that I kind of put together to the level that I had, at least for myself. And so I called up one of the world's leading experts and got her on the phone. She'd spoken at TED and she was an MIT professor and one of the leading experts in the world looking at these models of how our mind works and that type of thing, because she's in the effective computing department. And so she's supposed to be reviewing these models to make like emotions for computers and things like that. And she said, wow, no one has come at this from this approach. And it may be the most elegant model for the human catalysis or the cognitive catalysis of human emotions that we have. So she said, send me a white paper and to be continued. So I wrote a white paper for MIT and Georgia Tech, and I talked to some other leading experts and then turned that into the first book that I wrote a long time ago, How Emotions Work in Humans and Computers. And that was more focused on talking to systems engineers about how they might approach making emotions for computers, which means, you know, you had to have a system of understanding how they came in, how they came together in the human mind. And then over the next 10 years or so, I worked on the Mind Hacking Happiness books. With the I Am podcast, I started that in between the two. And I just started to try to explain to people, okay, well, so this is how your pain and suffering works. This is how your mind works. And maybe if you messed with those things a little bit, you could decrease the amount of pain and suffering that you're experiencing or your psychological discomfort, et cetera. But it was all theory at that point. It was still, no one had really done any science on it to figure out, you know, this is how it actually worked. It was more like, you know, it's a really good theory and it kind of fits some science or a lot of science that's been out, but no one really has done the legwork on making sure that this is accurate. And something happened between 2007 and 2012, which was all of the science caught up in a big hurry and basically proved the entirety of the whole model that I put together that I'd been using just to talk, you know, kind of a new age guru or not really kind of a science-based new age guru type of thing to say, hey, turn down your inner BS and get your life back. And all the science then proved that all the stuff that I'd been teaching in theory was actually accurate. And so then I was like, well, let me put all this science together. And that's where the Mind Hacking Happiness books came from. It was basically the same model that I'd been preaching for, you know, a half dozen years, and then put all the science, led with the science actually, and said, okay, here are the studies that prove what I'm about to talk to you about. And then laid out the whole model. And so that's how I kind of got into it. It was, you know, this internal awakening for myself, figuring out my own junk, and then sharing it with other folks and them saying, well, that's kind of how my junk works as well. And then starting to preach it, the science came along, and then I was like, well, shoot, if it's right, we got to put it out because it's helping people. I was getting a lot of feedback that, you know, they're like, holy crap, these tools that you're giving us for, you know, how to manage our mind and tackle our inner demons is like really effective. So I figured, well, if the science backs it up, now I've got to make a real run at it and, you know, put these other Mind Hacking Happiness books out. And that's kind of how the whole thing developed.
And so once you had that, the science backing up the theory that you had kind of come across yourself after taking your systems experience, when you were looking at the science, where did you kind of find where the neuroscience and psychology worlds kind of fell short in explaining the emotions and how this model kind of filled some of those gaps?
Well, and frankly, it's still falling short because, you know, in Mind Hacking Habits Volume 1, I explain the basis of, you know, the nervous system, how the nervous system works, how the mind compares a number of things. And basically, your nervous system is a big comparator. And I took that model and created a very simple way of explaining the nervous system called the equation of emotion, and defined all the logical definitions of the emotions that we have with anger group and fear group and sadness group, and worry and regret, and all these, you know, 40, 50 some variations of emotion. And science today, right now, is still arguing about the official definition of anger, official classifications of anger, when it's extremely clear, and Aristotle actually nailed it 2,000 years ago in his dissertations on the emotions. And, you know, I mentioned that in the book, but today science is still arguing on the definitions of these things we have laid out, which ironically, the Ekmans, I don't know if you know even Paul Ekman, but Paul Ekman was this emotions god from the 1960s forward in psychology. And now he's getting to a retirement age, but his daughter Eve is also a psychologist now, and they're a specialist in emotions. And they put together an emotions atlas just recently that basically almost fits hand in glove with what I put in Mind Hacking Happiness Volume 1. And we came up with the model independently from two different angles. They came at it from a data set analysis, and I came at it from a, well, here's how I think it works, and the science supports it, and here it is. Their model is basically exactly the same as mine is, with the definitions and the classifications and the groupings and things like that. So it was tough to find the support for a lot of this stuff. But I kind of set the alarm on the Google alerts thing and said, okay, here are the keywords that I want to read about. And so I got emails like once a week that said, hey, this popped up. Here's a study that proves this. So that was kind of how it happened.
And you mentioned in your theory, you mentioned then about the equation of emotion that you came up with. Can you just explain a little bit more in depth about the equation of emotion?
Yeah. You know, I mean, there's nothing really magical about the equation of emotion except in how you use it, right? So, you know, the nervous system in mass is basically just a big communications network inside the body. And it's a very simple communications network in that when it is trying to tell you something, it's always comparing one thing to another. And that's all the nervous system really does, is likes to compare one thing against another and then report on the difference. And so, like, when you put your hand on the stove, it's not really telling you, okay, so this is 180 degrees Fahrenheit and you need to remove your hand. It's saying, this is much hotter than it was a second ago, and you might want to consider moving your hand because it's, you know, hot enough to burn us. And so then, just like when you wake up in the middle of the night, like people will wake up in the middle of the night and they'll smell a natural gas leak, and they'll get up, and well, that's the nose reporting. From moment one, there wasn't gas. Moment two was, there's a lot of gas. You better wake up. And so it wakes you up, and then you walk around the house for 10 minutes. And then all of a sudden you don't smell it anymore, and you go think it's a dream, and you go back to bed, and gas kills the whole family. Well, that's the nervous system basically telling you, between time one and time two, there was zero gas to a lot of gas. Time two to time three, there was high gas, and now time three has high gas again. So I'm going to stop reporting it to you. I told it to you once, and I'm only reporting the differences in things. Well, the equation of emotion is exactly the same way. The nervous system creates all of our emotions. And so the two things that the nervous system compares are very specific. One is our expectation or preference about something, and the second is our perception with a little bit of an appraisal about that same something. So now this ties into your sense of self. The expectation or preference about something in your equation of motion is directly tied to an item on your self map. Now, let's talk about the self for just a second to explain the whole thing. The brain is your organ of survival. And so it is there to help you survive from yesterday into today through tomorrow. And so your memory is there to remember where the food and water is. Your cognition is there to help figure out how to build shelter from, you know, very basic survival mechanism need. And your humor is even there to figure out how to say funny things to get somebody to hop into bed, to propagate the species, that type of thing. But it is all day, every day, figuring out how to help you survive. And so in your brain, there's this thing called the limbic system, which its job is right above the brain stem. It's one of the most primitive structures in the mind or in the brain itself. And it's nothing more than a system of danger identification. So it is scanning your threats constantly, looking for potential threats to you. And so it reacts very quickly. So when you see that hose laying on the ground there next to the house or whatever, and you think it's a snake, and you jump a little bit, that's your limbic system in action. And so it's looking for all types of threats. And the process is, it looks for threats, but then a second question must be asked. Well, a threat to what exactly? What is it that I'm supposed to be protecting here? And so that creates the physiological need for your sense of self. You have to know, if you see a leafcutter ant crawling across the ground over there, whether or not you have leaves or whether or not you are a leaf. And so that's a ridiculous way of saying you kind of have to know the definition of who and what you are to be able to figure out what's a threat to you and what's not a threat to you. And so that's where your sense of self comes in. It's the laundry list of things that your mind uses to create the checklist of, is this a threat or is this not? Because if, you know, a baseball is flying at somebody else, well, that's not you, so there's no threat to you. It's not going to react. But if a baseball is flying at your head, then it is going to react because it does define a portion of your sense of self as your body. Now, the cool thing about the sense of self is that we used to think, psychology used to think, not too long ago, just a few years ago, that the self was just mainly the body. And there was some science, some recent science, that helped explain the self as more than the body. Jim Cohn at the University of Virginia put some folks in an fMRI machine where he basically said, okay, I'm going to give you a flash of light in these glasses. I'm going to wait a second to measure your brain, and then I'm going to shock your ankle. And what he was doing is trying to measure where the fear response was in the brain and, you know, what centers lit up so that he could identify where the self was in the brain, that type of thing, because it's a threat to self is what he was basically creating for these folks. So he took those pictures of their brain in the fear response, and he got exactly what he expected. And then he brought in a stranger, and he laid him down next to that same person. He said, okay, I'm going to take the ankle zapper off of your ankle, and I'm going to put it on their ankle. And then I'm going to give you the flash of light so you know when the zap's coming, and we're going to watch your brain, but then we're going to zap the stranger. And so then they did that, flash of light, waited, zapped the stranger, and they saw absolutely no fear response in the brain and no areas of the self lit up. And that was exactly what they expected as well. Then they did something very interesting. They brought in a familiar, which is what science calls a close friend or a loved one or somebody that really you care about who's a part of your world. And they said, okay, we're going to put the ankle zapper on their ankle now. And so they gave the same subject, the flashlight, watch the subject's brain, and then they zap their friend or their loved one or their spouse or child or whatever it was. And the results of the third brain scan test, the fMRI, showed exactly the same response as the first one when their body was zapped. And so what that showed was that other people can become mapped onto our sense of self. And so from there, there were some additional studies done that Tiffany Burnett White at UIUC proved that ideas of brand and value and things like that could be mapped onto the self because those same exact areas of the brain also were lit up at threats to the brand. And then Sam Harris did studies where he proved that religion and politics do the same thing. And they light up the same sections of the brain as well for self. Now, how this feeds back into the equation of emotion, you have a lot of things that could be mapped onto your sense of self. So it becomes, you know, more than your body. It becomes, of course, your body. Your body is the first thing you see when you look in the mirror. So your body's on your self map, but then so are also the friends and the loved ones that you have, which is why you can have emotions about other people and what's happening in their lives. But then you can also have emotions and reactions about things that you identify as your portion of your life, like your religion, your politics, your job, your car, your possessions, your everything that your mind thinks of as something that's connected with you can now generate an emotional response. And how that works is the expectation or preference, back to the equation of emotion, is always that everything on your self map, both the whole collection of everything and then each, every individual piece that lands on your map, be held at status quo or increased in value. That's something that's an extension of homeostasis. Everything's got to be cool in the body. And if it is, we're cool. And if everything's not cool, then we got to do something. And that's basically how your emotions work. So everything on your self map, like your mom and your job and your car and everything, has an expectation or preference that it's got to be cool. Or if it's not, then we got a problem. And the perception side of your equation of emotion basically is whatever's happening around you in the world, what your brain thinks of it. So if you have a favorite football team, let's say, and you have an expectation or preference that your football team be held at status quo or increased in value, which means they never lose a game, you don't see any negative headlines about them in the paper, you know, that type of thing. Well, if you have a perception comes in where they lost the game or where you see a negative headline about them or whatever, then you have the negative emotional reaction associated with that instance of the equation of emotion based on whether your football team did well or didn't do well or whatever. And so your nervous system is always comparing the two. It automatically assigns the expectation or preference of everything on your self map, and everything on your self map gets that assigned. And then any perception that comes in at any time, like you get a call and you know your mom has the flu now, boom, the expectation or preference has already been set. It's just sitting there waiting. The perception comes in that your mom's under threat, and then that's when you have the emotional reaction associated with that. And it's basically just a fancy way to explain the operation of the nervous system en masse, right? But specifically how your emotions are created within your mind. Now, the cool thing about that is when you understand how your emotions work, there's this really cool button in your brain that helps your brain turn off your negative emotional reactions when you understand them. And that's connected with a group of studies called the Name It, Tame It studies. And I don't mean to ramble on, but this is kind of painting the big picture for you on how and why your emotions work and why it's important to understand. Because Matt Lieberman at UCLA in 2007 started a study that became a whole group of studies, basically. And he showed that when you simply name an emotion, when you simply put a label on an emotional reaction you're having, that emotion stops generating in the limbic system of your brain. It's like a sneeze. You can't even stop it from happening. When you put some type of cognitive understanding to your emotion itself, then your emotion starts to downregulate and turn off. And so this is a way of basically hitting an off button. And it's not like repressing the emotion. It's not like, you know, we're ignoring it or whatever. It is literally processing the emotion to the point that it stops generating trouble for you. And the reason that happens is that your nervous system's a big communications channel. And the centers that send messages like to get confirmation that the messages were received and that you're doing something about it. And at the point that your limbic system sends the message And the portion of your brain is the medial prefrontal cortex and the right ventral lateral prefrontal cortex. When they send the messages back to the limbic system and say, no, that's actually not a snake. It's just a hose on the ground. Well, then your fear goes away. And so at the point that you can put a cognitive understanding to your emotions by learning about the equation of emotion and understanding your self map and the things that are on your self map and understanding, okay, the reason I'm pissed off about this is because, you know, this headline set me off because I have a connection to this religion or this politics or this whatever it is that set me off, and my perception came in and it didn't balance, boom, that turns off your negative reaction in real time. It's like a magic button. You can't really even control that it turns off. It's really cool. And so your negative crap goes away at that point. So it's like you go from compulsion of being led around by your emotions, you know, by your nose, or you have a choice to say, okay, I'm going to not use this. It's not going to be constructive for me to use this emotion. Like sometimes anger can be constructive. It can be a good motivating force, et cetera. Or you can say, okay, I'm not going to let that bother me at the moment and turn it off by simply understanding it and putting it in the model of the equation of emotion.
Yeah, I think it's really quite amazing once you do start to understand it. I mean, I had a moment where I was actually listening to the audiobook of Mind Hacking Happiness when I was in the car driving somewhere, sitting in traffic, and that concept of actually understanding that nothing or no one or a situation isn't making you feel that emotion. Your mind is making you feel that emotion. And that, you know, like you said, you can downregulate and turn that off. And it really helped even in that situation, in the moment while I was listening to you speak to me and tell me that. It was amazing to understand that more as well. And another important component that you mentioned in the podcast as well is obviously about this self-attachment map that we all have. And the component of ego. Can you just explain a little bit more about the component of ego and how that works in the equation of emotion? Because I think a lot of people have quite misconceptions, or they have a specific view of what they think the ego is.
Yeah. And so, and this is a really nebulous term that psychology used to use a lot, and they no longer use it. And so now, you know, New Age spiritual teachers like to use it a lot, and people who like to, you know, they're inner peace teachers, I guess. They like to use that word, and Eckhart Tolle uses it a lot. Basically, I equate the word ego to be interchangeable with the mind self. Now, I switched from ego. I used to say ego a lot a long time ago, and I switched to the mind's self because that's the scientific term. I mean, that's the term that, you know, psychology uses. That's the term that neuroscience uses to, you know, do their testing, do their experiments, and it's how they're what they're trying to define from a scientific perspective. I define ego as your mind's sense of self, which literally is the self map that I put into Mind Hacking Happiness. And so when a lot of people say ego, you know, a lot of, they'll think maybe, oh, you know, inflated ego or inflated sense of self or whatever. Well, no, really the ego, from a very specific basic definition, is anything that your mind thinks of when you think of you, that is your ego. That is an egoic response to your mind seeking a definition of self. Anything that you think is partially you, your stuff, is officially ego. Your job is officially ego. All the people around you, your ideas, your likes, your dislikes, your favorite sports teams, your favorite whatever, I consider that interchangeable with the sense of self of the brain. So when I say the word ego, that's exactly what I'm talking about. So when we talk about the self map, you could call it ego map. When we're talking about, you know, the sense of self, you'd say ego. I use those words interchangeably.
And I think another important you touched on before is the fear, the emotion of fear. Can you just explain a little bit about that? And obviously the mind's definition of the self, ego, the attachment and the power of attachment. Can you use these to overcome that fear?
Sure. Yeah, because the cool thing about your brain is that there's this thing called neuroplasticity. They've learned a lot about the brain in just the last couple of decades, where it used to be thought that when we got our brain, they thought, well, it grew from childhood into adulthood and it never changed. And what you got was, you know, what you're stuck with for the rest of your life. Neurons never get created. They can only die. And the structure of your brain never changes. Well, that's not true. They found out through a number of studies, and now that's called neuroplasticity, in that when you use your mind in certain ways, or you do certain things with your brain, it changes and it gets better at things. And the science is that when neurons fire together, they wire together. Well, basically, they did a number of studies, like for instance, the Knowledge in London, right? So London's got something like 100,000 different points of interest, and it has over 300 major avenues to get across town, and they've got tons of traffic. And so they decided to say, okay, well, to be a taxi driver in the city of London, you have to pass a test. And the test that they put up for these folks is an average of 4 years of studying and 7 attempts before you pass. It's like worse than the bar exam in the United States. People, even bad lawyers, can pass the bar in the 3rd or 4th try. But these cab drivers have to study and memorize all the points of interest, all the major traffic snarls that can happen, the one-way streets that change in the middle of the day, how to get without GPS from point A to point B any time of the day, any day of the week. And they have to do it from memory so that they don't make the traffic issue worse. Well, they did a study on these guys and showed that the brain does in fact change, and the cab drivers in London have larger memory centers because of all the studying that they were doing than they started with. And so they measured the brain before they started the whole process, then they let them go through the studying process, they passed the test, and all of a sudden their hippocampus was bigger, right? You have two sides of it, so both of them were bigger than they started with, which means they had better memory function because they were using their memory all the time. Well, the same thing is true when you start to regulate your emotions and you start to downregulate your fear response and things like that. You know, fear is simply defined as, and this is a universal definition, the fear is the emotional response we have when we experience a threat to self or when we perceive a threat to self. Now, the self map is a brand new way of understanding the self. So now, rather than just give it that general, you know, shade of gray definition, we can actually now say, I understand exactly why I'm nervous or fearful about my mom getting the flu, because my mom is on my self map, and we can run it through the equation of emotion. My perception is that the flu is a threat to my mom. Boom, there's the fear about mom having the flu. If you have a job and you hear about pending layoffs, right? So you're fearful that you're going to lose your job, and the things associated with your job also get planted on your self map. So your income, your money, the title that you're going to have as being unemployed, you know, that's a big red sticker that you have to wear on your chest, unfortunately, sometimes. All those arise because those individual things wind up on your sense of self, right? Your income, your ability to pay the bills, you know, and all that associated with that. So when you hear that the layoffs are coming, boom, now we have an instant understanding of why fear works exactly the way it does, even in these small instances of fear that we experience, even if there's not like a bear coming at us, or, you know, I guess down in Australia, you guys have deadly snakes or whatever, right? So you have a life-threatening natural enemy, a natural predator coming at you. Well, that's a threat to the body. That's why we jump out of our skin when we see those big snakes. But then it also explains why we have a fear of losing our job or a fear of mom getting the flu, because they're individual things that pop up on our self map. Well, when you start to take control and downregulate your negative emotional responses, your brain, just like when you practice crossword puzzles, you get faster and better at them. Just like when you practice shooting a basketball, you get faster and better at it. Just like when you play the piano, you get faster and better at it with practice. Your brain changes to help you do stuff unconsciously when you do it over and over and over again. And your brain will change in form and function based on how you use it. And so if you're using it all day long, every day, to downregulate your negative stuff, your brain gets a lot better at turning down your negative crap. And all of a sudden, life gets a lot more sunnier than it was without you even having to try and manage the process from a day-to-day perspective. It's really cool.
Is it about sort of changing your reality as it is perceived in terms of learning how to downregulate those emotions? Because if you take those examples that you just used there with, say, someone who has been laid off, or the pending possibility of that, which we'll get into later, which is comes under worry. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Women's Self-Help Podcast. Stay tuned for part 2 of our chat with Sean coming up shortly. If you would like to find out more information about the awesome work that Sean is doing, you can check out his books, Mind Hacking Happiness Volumes 1 and 2, at thewomensselfhealthpodcast.info/SeanWeb. Again, that website is womenshp.info/SeanWeb. If you enjoyed this episode, we would greatly appreciate it if you could please head to iTunes or wherever it is that you download your podcasts and leave us a review. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for part 2 of our chat with Sean coming up shortly.